It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. 23 people have been killed by tornadoes that hit Lee County, Alabama on Sunday. Tornadoes with winds up to 170 miles per hour devastated the region and hit areas as far away as Georgia and Florida. But nowhere was harder hit than Lee County.
I've lived in this community, this county, for all my life. So most people know me and I know them.
Bill Harris is the Lee County coroner in Opelika, Alabama.
You knock on somebody's door that you've known for 20, 30 years and to tell them one of their family members has died is just not an easy task. It's probably the hardest part of this job. No words that I can relay to them is going to make this any better. So my job is just try to do everything I can to ease them through this pain.
Bill says the scale of the tragedy took him and other local officials by surprise.
I quickly realized that my office would be overwhelmed based on the severity of the event. Just areas of mass destruction, it's a logistics problem. We'll set up a command center, and then the teams go out, and as they locate decedents, then they will notify us, and we'll send the recovery team out and recover that body, then bring it back here and identify it. Nobody's left this scene unless they were identified.
Search efforts are still underway. And other residents, including Dr. Mac McCoy, the superintendent of Lee County Schools, are trying to reunite families that were separated by the storm.
We are communicating with people, just trying to locate displaced families and help them come back together. Over the next several weeks, we will hope to have some sort of normalcy for the children themselves. We do know that we have at least three children that lost their life. We do know of children who've lost parents. So we will be doing a lot of grief counseling, both for children and adults, I'm sure for quite a while. When you lose a classmate, it can be devastating in just a classroom or a school setting or an entire community like it is right now.
Lee County schools are closed. Instead, Dr. McCoy told us the school buildings are being used as staging areas for first responders and the media.
I have not experienced anything quite like this as an adult or in my 35 years of being in school. This is a first, and one time's enough.
Today, community members in Lee County and surrounding areas are stepping in to provide support and resources to affected residents. Pastor Jeff Myers is among them. He's a pastor at First Baptist Church in Opelika, Alabama. Hi, Jeff. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the privilege of being with you.
So can you give us a sense of what the last 48 hours have been for your community? What has this moment been like?
Oh, I think in the spots that we just heard, it's an accurate description. Here was a community that was at peace, just going about their weekend, the normalcy of a Saturday and Sunday. Yeah, we were told that storms were on the way, but when you live in the Southeast, you're told that quite regularly this time of year. And the storms came and the storms went, and I don't think anybody foresaw or could know what was on the other side. I'll be honest with you, I'm a pastor, but Sunday morning, I was not in the pulpit of my church. My wife and I were celebrating our anniversary. We were out of town. We quickly came back into town when we heard what occurred, went straight into the hospital there in Lee County, East Alabama Medical Center that's located in Opelika. And it was a scene like nothing I'd ever been a part of.
Can you describe the scene for us?
Well, the scene was a constant stream of ambulances, a constant stream of helicopters. The wounded and even more severe than that were consistently coming in. But what I saw, and if you'll forgive the emotions, was a community that came together. Every personnel from the hospital, every member, both volunteer and on staff, was there. There were representatives of probably at least 15 to 20 different churches and significant groups in the community that were there. Everybody was helping everybody. Everybody was assisting. And, you know, just as you heard, what do you say to somebody who's experienced, you know, a child being ripped out of their arms by 170 mile an hour winds? What do you say? You don't say anything. You just listen to them. You cry with them and you mourn with them. But the whole community has just, in the last 48 hours, we were a pretty close-knit community to begin with. And now we're really close because we have to be in these times.
I totally understand and can understand and feel the emotion in your voice, Pastor. I'm wondering, tell us a little bit about the church itself. What has the church been doing? It's been, I'm sure it's a crazy couple of days here. Walk us through some of the needs that the community has right now. Are people looking for shelter? Are they looking for food? Are they looking for emotional support?
The answer is yes, all of those things. And, you know, quite simply, you know, when people are asking, how can we help? How can we assist? You know, the quickest and most immediate is people who are going to a variety of websites, including ours, which is fbcopelika.com, and they're contributing monetarily. And those funds are going to provide shelter. We have hundreds of families that are completely displaced. It's not that their house or their living dwelling place is damaged. It's gone. So there are, you know, we're providing shelter, we're providing clothing. The best illustration I can give is I ask people to imagine that you come home one day and unexpectedly everything that you claim to possess is gone. Everything. You know, this may sound strange to your listeners, but one of the greatest needs in our community are diapers, undergarments, personal hygiene products. They don't have bars of soap. They don't have shampoo. They don't have socks, you know, and just what we consider oftentimes in our culture, the basics of life. We got a call yesterday. There's a man coming from Maryland with a tractor trailer of diapers of all sizes that is going to be such a blessing to this community because, as you heard, not only were children directly affected, but families and houses, you know, that are no longer there. So all the needs that are necessary both tangibly and monetarily if people cannot actually tangibly give. But as far as getting on the ground and helping people rebuild their lives, First Baptist Opelika has partnered with Samaritan's Purse, one of the largest gospel-centered relief agencies in the world. They're going to be living in our church, they're going to be eating in our church, and then they're going to be taking hundreds of volunteers every day out in the community helping people rebuild their lives. So there's a lot of different areas there. If your listeners want to volunteer in Opelika, Alabama, they can go to spvolunteer.org. They can sign up for a day, a week, whatever. We're going to need folks for a long time in East Alabama.
And of course, we know, Jeff, that Alabama has been struck by tornadoes before. I know you said you hadn't seen anything like this, but had you and the community dealt with other severe weather events before? Was there a sense of, you know, being able to sort of pick up on that information, or was this totally new?
Well, of course, there are significant weather events in all locations over time. I mean, we've experienced hurricanes in different locations, tornadoes, even the gravity of a tsunami. So I think all of us, wherever we live, are used to the occurrence of these type of events. The best way I can describe it is I was talking to a hospital administrator Sunday night as things were starting to somewhat calm down. And this individual shared with me that as a hospital, they prepare both for what we would call the natural and even the man-made disasters on a regular basis. And they communicated to me that for over two decades, they had prepared for an event such as this, no matter how it came to the community. And it's the first time in over two decades something of this magnitude took place. And so this is a very unique event in our community. We've had storms, we've had destruction. But as you said, when you have over 20 lives lost, both adults and children, within moments, it is a tragedy unparalleled.
Now, also, you are on the phone with me via Skype. I'm part of the media. There are tons of media. The town is essentially feels like it's inundated with media when things like this happen. We mentioned at the top of the show that the school is being used as a media center. What's the feeling there when something like this happens and suddenly Lee County is on the headlines of every news outlet in the country? Does it feel exploitative or does it feel like you guys are having your stories told accurately?
Well, I can speak personally. It feels like our stories are being told accurately. And I think the one thing that I'm sharing as a pastor, and I know many others are, I'm a realist. I've been around a while. I know that in a few days, in a few weeks, that the story of Lee County, Alabama, and particularly the communities that were affected, it's going to begin to go down on the news feeds of people's life. And we realize that. Right now, it's the lead story. Right now, everybody's focusing on Opelika, Alabama, and the surrounding community. And I understand that. And the message that we're trying to communicate is thank you for listening to our stories. Thank you for sending help. But don't forget about us in 3 weeks and in 3 months, because lives are still going to be broken and homes are still going to be destroyed. And so we're just communicating, thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for the gifts. Thank you for all the attention and allowing the story to be told, but just emphasizing that whether it's here in East Alabama or other places we've seen destruction in the past and will most definitely in the future, is those people who we focus on so intently in a brief amount of time, don't forget, they need some of your attention down the road as well. And so everything I'm experiencing from a pastor's perspective, from a community member's perspective, in relation to the media has been positive. People listening to the story, I think the loss of life and the destruction, when you see it with your eyes, there is an incredible amount of sympathy, if not empathy, that comes from any person who's on the ground here and realizing what these families are going through.
The things that you're describing are quite intense, and we are sending our best thoughts to you and the community. Pastor Jeff Myers is a pastor at First Baptist Church in Opelika, Alabama. Jeff, thank you again.
Thank you so much for your time.
Outside of Lee County, Sunday storms also affected parts of Georgia and Florida. And we've been hearing your stories.
The tornado came through North Florida, South Georgia on Sunday. That area is still trying to get over Hurricane Michael from October 2018. There's still carnage in the area where trees were knocked down and roofs were blown off of homes. So they're still recovering. And then for a tornado to come through the area Sunday adds to the already devastated area.
Hello, my name is Carla Naomi. I'm calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Last night, thankfully, my husband and I ended up leaving Florida a little too late. However, as we were passing through Georgia, there were several stretches where there was so much debris everywhere in the median and on the sides of the road. Even all over the road, I mean, huge, thick tree trunks just ripped out of the ground and thrown. I mean, it was ridiculous, and it was really scary because it was very dark, and you really didn't see the debris until you were almost upon it. I mean, I almost got into an accident. It was very impactful. We had heard that the storms had been bad. We had heard that the tornadoes had been bad, but we have lived in Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina. We had never seen anything like that.
Tell us your experience with Sunday's deadly tornadoes. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway. Last week, amid a flurry of other news, White House senior advisor and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, met with the Saudi Arabian king and crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. It was the first meeting between the two since journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed in October. The two men have a close relationship that dates back to the early days of the Trump administration, and Kushner has advocated for bin Salman from within the White House, even after the American intelligence community determined bin Salman ordered agents to kill Khashoggi. I'm joined now by David Kirkpatrick, international correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you.
So tell us about this meeting last week between Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman. What do we know about it, and how come it didn't? I mean, we know Michael Cohen testimony was happening, which sort of, you know, overshadowed everything else. But how much was this reported on?
Well, it wasn't really announced until after the fact. So it was all choreographed in such a way as not to attract a lot of attention. It was part of a tour of the region by Jared Kushner, intending to promote his Middle East peace plan, that is his plan for some kind of an accord between the Israelis and the Palestinians. He's hoping that Crown Prince Mohammed will play a big role in making that come to fruition.
Let's talk a little bit about their relationship prior to this meeting. Kushner and bin Salman have been close for a while. What prompted their relationship?
You know, we don't really know how it started, to be honest. But by the time Crown Prince Mohammed shows up for his first visit to the White House in the spring of 2017, others in the administration noticed that they're talking like old friends. They've been in touch before. And as early as the inauguration at the start of 2017, Jared Kushner had already been sold on the idea that President Trump should make an early foreign trip, if not his first foreign trip, to Riyadh for a big Arab summit to be hosted by the Saudis. So he was already, even then, gearing up to place a big bet on Crown Prince Mohammed. And his ability, at the time, he was only, I think, 31 or 32 years old, to lead the region and to rally the Arab world around this this peace proposal.
Now, this is the first time, the, going back to the meeting that they had last week, this was the first time that bin Salman and Kushner had met face-to-face since Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. But they've been in communication over that time as well, right? They had kept up communication, you've written.
Yes, they have. They have a WhatsApp relationship, they have a texting relationship, and they have, to the dismay of some in the government, they appear to have an informal pattern of communication. Now, Jared Kushner's spokespeople say he complies with all rules about communications with foreign leaders. But what's happening there raises some questions among others in the administration because they think that Jared Kushner is not very experienced in the region or even in international politics, that he might be manipulable. And that in any case, you know, other interests within the U.S. government like to have a readout on any conversation with an important foreign leader. You know, there's a lot of different constituencies in the U.S. government, the aid people, the defense people, the State Department people, the human rights people. They all want to know what is being said in this kind of a high-level dialogue.
And how is it possible that they, that Kushner and bin Salman are able to get around that, those protocols?
Well, he wouldn't be the first. You know, Secretary Kerry would sometimes have one-on-one informal calls with figures in the Middle East or other world leaders, and then, you know, report back, or intelligence agencies would find out about it, and a reports would be shared. So it's not unprecedented for there to be impromptu conversations between a White House official and a foreign leader. How much that is shared, whether it's conducted through some kind of an encrypted calling service, all of that, and thus not captured by U.S. intelligence, you know, we don't really know the details of that. It's there's a lot of questions around that right now.
This idea that Kushner would be trying to negotiate some sort of a peace accord, and in the shadow of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, feels at the very least incongruent to me. How do we make sense of that, David?
Well, the United States is not alone among Western governments looking at Saudi Arabia right now. And what they see is this young crown prince. He's 33 years old. He's behaving, some would say, erratically. That includes directing the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, but also kidnapping the prime minister of Lebanon, or summarily rounding up 200 of his kingdom's richest people and locking them in the Ritz-Carlton without any kind of judicial process. The war in Yemen, the list goes on. So they see him and they think, well, this guy could be kind of erratic. He's very aggressive. He could be destabilizing. On the other hand, chances are he's going to rule this very important kingdom for the next 50 years. So it's not an easy choice for any of those governments or the United States government. Do you say we're just not going to talk to this guy? That's not so tenable. On the other hand, Jared Kushner is saying not only we need to talk to him, but he can be the linchpin of this regional peace accord, which is sort of taking it in the other direction.
There's also lots of concern recently about Kushner's security clearance. Can you help us understand what exactly he has and whether or not he should have that?
Well, what my colleagues in Washington have recently reported is that President Trump intervened in the process to allow him a top-level security clearance, him, Jared Kushner. It had been previously reported by our own paper and the Washington Post that people in the intelligence agencies had picked up foreign powers talking about how they might be able to exploit Jared Kushner or the Kushner family's financial positions for influence. You know, Jared Kushner and the Kushner family are in the real estate business. They've had properties that have had large amounts of debts that need to be settled. That might be an opportunity for foreign leaders, perhaps in the Gulf, where they're big real estate investors themselves, to try to influence him. That's one concern that's come up. We don't necessarily know all of the concerns that might have made people resistant to giving him a security clearance earlier.
David Kirkpatrick is an international correspondent for The New York Times and the author of the book Into the Hands of the Soldiers. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Evo, Evo, no talent to fall. Gloria, bravo,
That's the sound of Venezuelans singing the national anthem alongside Juan Guaido in just show of support. The 35-year-old opposition leader and self-declared president of the country has been backed by the U.S. and other nations in their demands that President Nicolás Maduro step down. Yesterday, Guaido returned to Venezuela after a 10-day tour through Latin America, attempting to generate support for his self-declared presidency. Venezuela has been dealing with an economic, political, and social crisis under President Maduro, and now that Guaido has returned, the world is watching to see who will end up taking control. Ana Vanessa Herrero is a New York Times reporter in Caracas who's been covering the political turmoil. Thanks for being with us, Ana.
Hi, Tensina. Thanks for having me.
So it wasn't clear that Guaido was going to be able to return to Venezuela without being captured or arrested. Instead, he was greeted with all this fanfare. What was the reception like?
Well, it was a very huge and shocking reception because many people at the rally where I was this Monday were really shocked by the fact that he wasn't arrested because, you know, we know for a fact and for past examples that Nicolás Maduro has easily arrested many of his opponents for less than what Juan Guaido has done. So people were shocked, and it was like a fresh air to every single one of the ones who were at the square when Guaido gave his speech in Caracas. Now, at the airport, the thing was more or less the same, even more cheerful, if I may, because he came in a commercial flight, which is not common for Venezuelan politicians. He gave some words to the passengers at the Copa Airlines flight to Caracas from Panama. And then he was greeted at the airport like a chief of state. He got a stamp on his passport. He was greeted by the airport staff, which I have to make this very clear. It's military, police. I mean, the airport is controlled by the military and the police.
But the military support Maduro, right? I mean, is it generally speaking, or was that a surprise as well?
Well, I mean, that support Maduro, yes and no. Yes, the high rank officials of the military support Nicolás Maduro. That's, you know, that's obvious and it's a fact. But the troops and lower ranks, that's the question. And, you know, Juan Guaido himself was saying yesterday, well, I'm here because of a reason. I'm here because they let me in. This was the perfect excuse for Nicolás Maduro to arrest Juan Guaido if he wanted to.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Juan Guaido's support, because he was relatively unknown. And I'm not sure if that's just to international audiences or within the country. But is this based on support for him and his policies, or is it based on the fact that people want a change from what they've been experiencing, this crisis that they've had under Maduro?
Well, a little bit of both, actually. It is based on the fact that most Venezuelans right now don't support the Nicolás Maduro's government. They don't want this kind of policies, economy policies. They don't want more either socialism, communism. They just want to live better. They just want to get anything they want and they need from a supermarket without depending on the government. That's one. But the other, I mean, there's a fact also that Juan with those policies and the fact that he was unknown for international audiences, but also for national audiences, because he wasn't the most popular of the congressmen, although he was known to be very sober and very good at his job. He wasn't the one who took the headlines of the newspapers, of local newspapers.
We talked a lot about support for Maduro in terms of the high-ranking military officials, but there are also people in the military and people who in the country who oppose Guaido. And partly that's because they see him as a threat to some of the social programs that were put in place by the former president, Chavez. What is the sense here? And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with Guaido and the United States' relationship. There seems to be some concern about what the U.S. involvement could be. Does this indicate that Guaido might get rid of these social programs?
Well, I think that is a very good question, but it's not that simple. The social programs were being subsidized by Venezuelan money, oil money, and now there's no oil and there's no money. So if he's going to get rid of the social programs or not, that's something, you know, we would have to wait and see first if he's going to, you know, make it to and formalize this the presidency. And but then we really don't know how far away the damage has been in the Venezuelan economy, because the Maduro's government hasn't released numbers, real numbers, for I think now almost 5 years. So we really don't know how much we're talking about. How much money does Venezuela have? How much money does Venezuelan oil has? And where's that money going? And where's its stage?
Does the fact that Maduro did not arrest Guaido when he got back to the country indicate a weakness in Maduro right now?
I am sure. Yes, yes, definitely. It does. And not only in Maduro, but around Maduro, and from the support that he said he had from the military and the police and the security forces of Venezuela. Definitely, this was a huge victory for Juan Guaido. And, you have to read between the lines with this, with what happened. Who is behind that decision? Who said, let the guy in? And that's a big question. And I think, we are going to see that very soon, because this can't take any longer if they're not even following their own instructions.
Anna Vanessa Herrero is a New York Times reporter in Caracas. Anna, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
We round out today's show in the world of wildlife poaching. It's a big business. And conservation nonprofits put hefty resources behind protecting parks and wildlife sanctuaries from poachers who are looking for things like ivory and animal skins. The Worldwide Fund for Nature, known here in the U.S. as the World Wildlife Fund, is one such organization. But according to a new investigation from BuzzFeed News, that charity has also been funding anti-poaching guards in Africa and Asia who have committed gross human rights abuses, including torture and murder. Katie J.M. Baker is one of the investigative reporters behind the story, and she joins us now from London. Katie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katie, so what was it exactly that you found? What are the abuses, and who is allegedly committing them?
We found that in six different countries in Africa and Asia, the forest rangers who patrol national parks combating poaching have been accused of torturing, murdering, sexually assaulting, and other crimes against the indigenous people who, in many cases, have been relocated so that those parks can exist. And our investigation looked into WWF's role in this, and we found that they, while claiming to work hand in hand with indigenous communities, have also been funding and training and equipping these forces for quite some time.
You talk about a war on poaching. Who are the players in this war, and how is it playing out?
So poaching is a billion-dollar industry that terrorizes animals and threatens some species' very existence, and poachers do take advantage of regions where there is poverty and violence. And in a lot of the countries we are looking into, that is the situation on the ground. But what we were told by WWF itself is that their target is these out-of-town poaching kingpins, not the indigenous people on the ground, some of whom sometimes do help out poachers, but on a very low level. And sometimes these people are just fishing or doing small-scale hunting legally, and the forest rangers see them around and will go over and start abusing them or torturing them without, any due process at all. So you have, instead of in the name of fighting poaching, you have indigenous people, many of whom have been barred to access in these national parks, being very mistreated.
Was the WWF aware of this kind of abuse that was happening?
WWF said that they're commissioning an external review by a law firm into the findings in our story, but further reporting from us will show that they have commissioned this type of review before, and we will be detailing a review that found that WWF was complicit in human rights abuses by forest rangers on the ground.
Have they turned a blind eye to this in your findings?
WWF says that they take any abuses very seriously. They say all human rights abuses are a red line and that they investigate any complaint that they receive of this nature. However, our investigation found that there are rangers who have openly confessed to waterboarding and torturing poaching suspects, yet WWF has funded these forces and even given them awards. We've spoken to families in Cameroon that said that they were tortured by forest rangers at a WWF-supported park. The family submitted a complaint, and they said that they never heard back months later. So while the charity does say that they take this seriously, our reporting found some gaps there.
Can you take us through a specific story of the abuse that you're finding here? I think you mentioned a story in Nepal.
Yes. So one of the cases in our first story was an indigenous farmer from a Taru tribe named Shikaram Chadhari. Shikaram was arrested and detained by forest rangers at Chitwan National Park in Nepal, who believed that he had helped his son bury a rhinoceros horn in his backyard. They didn't find the horn, but they locked him up anyway, because in Nepal, park rangers can arrest anyone without a warrant. And 9 days later, after being detained in the jail at the park, he was dead. 7 different eyewitnesses and activists and Shikaram's wife and daughter all said that he had been tortured during his detainment. The park said that he just fell off a bench and that it was kind of an uneventful week. And there was a big controversy, and 3 officials from the park were arrested. But as our reporting found, WWF helped lobby for the charges to be dropped. They celebrated once the charges were dropped, and then they later hired one of the alleged killers to work directly for them on the ground. And then they gave one of the second rangers a special award, even after he had written this kind of bizarre memoir confessing to waterboarding other suspects at the park.
Katie, I just want to make sure I understand, what's motivating this level of violence in this war on poaching? Is it money? Yeah, is it fame? Is it, what is it?
That's a good question. Well, like I said before, poaching is a really serious issue. It is a billion-dollar industry run by these international kingpins. It is threatening wildlife, and it is really important to fight back against it. And WWF has very good reasons for trying to stop poachers. But we feel that the voices of indigenous people who are the collateral damage in this war against poaching haven't gotten the chance to describe their experiences and talk about, how this war has affected them. And that's why we wrote our story, because while we do think that it's important to fight poaching, we also think it's important to listen to the voices of the indigenous people who say that they are being abused as part of this war.
There are lots of Americans, I'm sure, and people around the world who've either contributed to this organization or believe in the ideals that they stand for. For those people who care about conservation, who care about protecting wildlife, what is this story? What's the takeaway for them from this story?
I think that WWF does really great work, and I hope that donors who are upset by the revelations in our story will urge them to do better and be more transparent about the way that they handle complaints of abuse by forest rangers. I think that WWF could be more transparent about the way that they investigate such claims. I think that a reason why our story might be shocking to people is because all you read about on WWF's website is how well they work with indigenous communities. And while it may be true that they have had some really incredible collaborations with communities on the ground, these stories aren't being told. And so I hope that donors will encourage WWF to be more open about what's happening in regards to allegations of abuse.
All right. Katie J.M. Baker is an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed News, and we have a link to the piece on our website, thetakeaway.org. Katie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
That's all for us today, but alas, sad story. Many of my fellow Gen Xers are mourning actor Luke Perry, who passed away yesterday. Our director Jay and wrestling fans across the country are also in mourning. Christopher Pallies, better known as King Kong Bundy, passed away suddenly at 61 years old late last night. Bundy was a behemoth of a man, nearly a cartoon character with his terrifying scowls, and he was an all-time classic with appearances in several WrestleManias and TV stardom well into his 50s. He also joined a class action lawsuit against the WWE in 2016, arguing that it caused lasting injuries. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.